Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 204th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Ali Akavan and Don Hessel. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have producer and production company owner Becky Morrison on the podcast. She's also the founder of Globetops, which is an organization that takes people's old laptops that they don't use and gives them to people that don't have laptops.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, we had a fun conversation with Becky. I feel like we were at odds sometimes because she is firmly on the producing side of film, and she is working on some really cool efforts to kind of revolutionize the way productions run, the way they are more inclusive. We talked a lot about how she has like a new style of call sheet for her shoots, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, we get into the specifics on the ways in which she really wants to revolutionize production. And I think it's really a fascinating insight into, I think, the way that production companies are potentially moving, or at least a vision for the way that they're headed.
For sure. Her company, The Light.NYC. If you want to check it out, they are using this newer model that we're seeing more and more of production companies first and not having like a real roster of directors, but rather like a group of various directors that they work with based on what the job is. So it's cool. I think we learned a lot, and I think you'll enjoy this conversation.
Yeah. Before we hop into that conversation with Becky, though, let's talk a little bit about our Patreon.
Yeah. Patreon.com/justshootitpod.
That's the one. You can throw us a couple bucks just to kind of say, hey, thank you, and support our editors and our server space and all of the stuff that goes into the podcast. We are not yet breaking even, but we're getting pretty darn close, which is exciting. And it's all thanks to you guys contributing to the Patreon.
And Matt, can you tell us a little bit about our panel guests and theme for our March 15th live show?
It's the Ides of March live show that basically will be themed around managers, agents, and lawyers.
All of the reps.
All of whom murdered Caesar, I guess, in this metaphor.
Yeah, I also like to think of it as like the recovery day after the hangover you get from National Pie Day.
Mm-hmm. We're going to put together a panel of suits, we'll say, to talk about what it is to collaborate with a team of people and maybe how you can even find your very own.
Yeah, it'll be a night of Shakespearean drama in the agency.
Yeah, togas are required, everyone.
Right. But also, if you're a patron, you get in for free. So, hey, if you want to find out more about it, we are going to post about it very soon. Just shootitpod.com/live. But don't go there yet because the webpage might not be
old. But we're working on it. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, cool. And feel free to rate us on iTunes, too.
Yeah, drop us a review. We'd love it.
Well, okay. Without further delay, let's
enter the great beyond.
Let's go towards the light with Becky Morrison. Hey, we are here with Becky Morrison.
Hello.
Thanks for coming. All the way from New York City.
That's right. Brooklyn, baby.
Yeah. So, Becky, you have a production company.
I do.
You founded it. The Light.
Correct.
And are you the sole owner or do you have partners?
I am.
Okay. And why did you start it?
Well, I was a freelance producer for a long time. And the company where I was working got a new head of production. Mm-hmm. And that new head of production stopped looking at the actuals that I submitted and got very busy. And I started to, in a sense, have an existential crisis.
Mm-hmm. And is this like a commercial production house?
It was, yes.
In New York?
Exactly.
A famous one?
One that shall remain unnamed. So the head of production wasn't really acknowledging the work that I was doing. Mm-hmm. I'd come in under budget. I'd turn in the budget, all proud, waiting for acknowledgement and praise, perhaps an extra day or two. And that stopped happening. I think what that did is it spun me into a tailspin of like, well, what is the point of any of this, actually? If I'm going to work so hard, I'm going to make these deals, I'm going to save money for this company based on my relationships, and then it's not even going to be seen or acknowledged. And so I think that was the beginning of me starting to feel like I wanted to do something else. Mm-hmm. And I still am friends with two directors and another producer, and started speaking to them about forming our own production company, all three of them men. And I thought, this is a perfect scenario because they have clients, they have contacts, so they'll bring that to the business and then I'll do all the work.
Sure. Right. Yeah. But I mean, there is a lot of value in relationships.
Yeah, really. Right? Yeah.
The pre-existing relationships.
That it's work to build those relationships.
Exactly. So I think that really also came from my insecurity in a way, and thinking, oh, I can't start a production company on my own. I need these men to do it with me. Mm-hmm. And we were all also very busy with our regular jobs and nothing came of it. And so I was actually at a meditation retreat and the thought bubbled up and came to me, why don't you just start the company?
By yourself?
By myself, but more, it wasn't even by myself at that time. It was more like just start the company structure. Mm-hmm. And then when you need it, it will be there.
Right. If you build it, they will come.
Exactly. I wasn't thinking that at the time, but that's exactly what happened. I went home, I talked to a lawyer friend, I set up the company structure thinking, okay, well, when we get things activated, it will be here. But actually, as soon as I started the company, I started to get calls for jobs. It was bizarre.
I mean, how did people know about you?
They didn't.
So was it just like, oh, we're going to call Becky because we need a freelancer? And then you were like, well, it just so happens that I just set this thing up. Like, what if I just ran with it? Was that how it worked, or?
Exactly. It was very small at first. So it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, some huge client came to me and they were like, finally, you have a company. Sure. Now we can work with you. It was the first project was a very small conference for a business conference. And they came to me and they said, you know, can you produce the live video for this project? And do you have a company we can run it through? As a matter of fact, I just opened a company.
And had you worked with people at this event before, or were you a referral? How did it fall into your lap?
It was a referral. Somebody I had met.
Right. So your contacts, basically.
Yeah. Yes. Very small scale. And I had a check for $10,000, which was the budget of the whole project, before I had a bank account. So I was at the bank. Can you please open up this bank account so I could put this check in it? You know, right from the get-go.
Yeah.
And they said, you need a federal employee ID number.
I said, I have that, thankfully.
Yeah, she talked to her lawyer friend, yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, sorry to segue, but what are the minimum things to be a production company? Like, do you have to have an LLC or an S-Corp or something?
Yes.
And then a bank account, ideally?
Well, that was the second part. Really, the first part was I set up a corporation. I think initially, I don't remember what kind, but I then transferred it into an S-Corp. So that's what we are now. And in the state of New York, you can be tax exempt if you're a film production company. So we
are you serious?
Yes. Tax exempt on rentals and that kind of thing.
Oh, man.
Okay. But do you have to pay? Like in California, it's $800 a year to have an LLC or an S-Corp. Do you have that fee?
That's in minimum taxes, basically. So it's a fee if you don't meet that amount of taxation, basically.
Right. So what about, do you have to have production insurance to be a production company?
Yes, we do now. But when we first started, we didn't even have production insurance. I think the bare minimum was a corporate structure and then a bank account. And then we became tax exempt. And then we got production insurance. And then we got a website. And then I got business cards, got an office, you know, all that kind of stuff.
That's pretty much the order. I feel like some people start with a website. Like, I can't tell you how many of our listeners are like filmmakers, like one man shows, one man bands. And I also, of course, I mean, one woman bands. And they have like a website that's like Oren Productions, you know, and it's like set up as a production company. But yeah, that all makes sense. Because a lot of times I think people do come into like random jobs like, oh, my cousin's looking for a commercial for this thing. And he's asking me for a referral and I want to do it. And yeah, you're like, and how can I, ready, can I do it? Yeah.
Right. I guess the flip side being like, if you know someone who already has that structure, running it through them is the kind of the other early step alternative, right? Did you find that when you were first starting your company that people were looking to you for that sort of help as well or no?
In terms of them having productions that they needed some place to run it through?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. And it was very slow going. So it was the kind of thing where someone would call me with a job, a client, as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. I'd say, well, actually, I have a company. Can we run it through that? They said, yes, that would be great. So it was slow going and I was still freelance line producing at the time, back and forth. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I committed fully to the company, to the light, and to working with that and only that.
Was there a tipping point for you where you decided, oh, if I go all in on this, it's really going to become something? Or how did you make that leap, you know? Because I think a lot of our listeners are probably can relate to a certain extent of like, oh, you know, you pick up a job here or there, but you have some sort of side hustle or day job or something. And knowing when to commit, I think, can be a challenge for people, you know?
Absolutely. I remember the moment when I decided. My father, when I was growing up, was a corporate consultant. And in my early 20s, he moved to India and became a Hindu monk.
Wow. Sure. Okay. Yeah.
And we were together in Ireland having dinner. I remember I was eating soup and we were sitting there and I was in this place inside myself where I was going back and forth working for a production company and then working for the light. And I was very scared about taking the jump fully to work only with the light because I felt like, look, if I commit to that and it doesn't work out, what am I going to do?
Sure.
Yeah, for the record, I just want to say I'm not going to make any puns about the name of your business.
Oren, please, I welcome all the puns. They're all built right in there. It's intentional, so you don't have to avoid the puns. Okay. Lean in.
You don't know what you've done. What have you wrought?
I've opened up the floodgates. So I was concerned also that if I committed to working fully with the light and it didn't work out, that my contacts would dry up and that I wouldn't have any more job opportunities. And I remember my dad turned to me and said, so let me get this straight. You don't have faith in the light? And I was like, well, when you put it that way, because I am a very spiritual person. And when he said that, it was like, of course I do. I do. And I made the decision. I'm going to go for it. If it doesn't work out, I'll pick myself back up.
Sure. Yeah.
And I did. I committed to working fully with the light. And so far, it's worked out.
And how many years ago was that?
We're going into our fifth year now.
Okay, cool. And yeah, if you go to your website, you've done a billion things with like all these famous people, including Hillary Clinton and Bill Murray.
Yes, to name a few. And Meghan Markle.
And Meghan Markle and the Portlandia duo. You've worked for Geico, who makes the best commercials. So how did you go from that $10,000 video to like working with all these giant brands and corporations?
And also 5 years is pretty darn fast, you know?
What was the next step?
It's step by step, right? It's nice to hear that feedback because in a way it's just one foot in front of another, one job after another. And here we are.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk about then. So after that first event, what was the first kind of maybe six-figure job? Let's talk about that, you know, or even that just another milestone is really what I'm getting at, right? Because I think, again, there are people at home who are listening and you know, are cobbling together a few jobs, but like that step of like, okay, they're committed. And then what is that secret? Is it like, it's got to be a combination of reputation and additional networking and like relationships, right?
I see what you're saying. Yes. I think for me, with my path, it was more that I didn't realize what I already had. So I'd been working in the industry for many years as a production assistant, coordinator, production manager, line producer. And the contacts that I had made throughout that time ended up coming back around. So it was very, my challenge at first was I can't take any clients from the production company where I've been working.
Right, right.
And those are my contacts. But what happens is that over time, those people leave, they get another job, they remember you from all those years before.
They end up on corporate side or something, and then they're like, oh, who can I hit up to like produce this thing for me? Yeah.
Exactly, which is why it's so important never to burn bridges.
Sure.
Because those people that we may think like, oh, that was an annoying client on this job, they may end up being the ones who fund your entire production company 4 years from now.
Right, right. The way you were described to us as someone that's like trying to change the culture of production.
In terms of changing the culture of production, what I mean is that there is a specific language that we use in production. There's a specific way that we are when we're on set, right?
Can you give us a specific, like an example?
Sure. We use a lot of language on the walkie, right? So we say...
You say copy or whatever. Right?
What's your 20?
Yeah.
I'm 10-1.
Yeah, yeah.
Copy the that.
Lingo, jargon is what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Or also shoot, right? Just shoot it. Or we're in the trenches. You know, we're that language of production.
Like it's a little
militaristic.
Militaristic, yeah.
It is militaristic, exactly. Yeah. And I think that militaristic culture of production, it's not accidental. Right. And I started to really research what's the origin of production. And I think that if you take the example that being on set or production is militaristic, right? But what we're actually doing is perhaps filming a dog in a hoodie or a penguin waddling through a zoo.
Yeah.
But the culture of the way that we approach that creative is militaristic. That's problematic.
Sure.
To me.
Yeah.
And I think in need of an upgrade.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I've always thought that like to me, filmmaking is like being in, I think I've said this on the podcast before, it's kind of like being in the army, but instead of like destroying things, you're creating things. But there's this hierarchy and, you know, you have like your departments and your head, the heads of your departments. And like, you know, a lot of times, like if I'm on a bigger shoot, I'm not even supposed to talk to like best boy grip or whatever, right? Because like that's supposed to go through the DP and through the key grip or the gaffer or whatever. So there's something kind of cool about that. Even if I'm doing a commercial for dog hoodies or whatever, I feel like I'm part plugged into the system. I feel like militaristic might have this negative connotation of like going to battle, but I think there's something cool about being plugged into that system and into those hierarchies and everyone knows what their job is. And I don't know, I think there's something cool about it, but
I get what you're saying. I think that another way to talk about it is that is also the teamwork and the collaboration and the unity and the intensity of the circumstances. You know, we work long hours, we're in intense circumstances, and we get very close with people who we're on set with. And that camaraderie, I think there can be parallels to the military. But I also think that there's a cost to the culture of production, to the way that people are treated and the way that people are told to be quiet and this is the way it is and not to ask questions and to do what you're told. And I think that culture of production in a lot of ways has perpetuated the abuse that we're seeing come out in the industry now. So I think you're right. There is a magical unity that can come out of it. And there's also an abuse and really a disregard of the completeness of who we are as human beings. And that's the part that we as a production company are very interested in addressing and ultimately changing.
How are some of the ways that you have addressed those ideas? Like what specifically is it that you do that alters the culture?
So there's things that we're doing, and I'll caveat that by saying that we're in no way, we don't have the answers.
Sure.
I think what I'm very interested in doing, which is why I'm here speaking with you and everybody out there, is inspiring a conversation to get people thinking around innovating production.
Or just questioning, why is it that we do it this way? Right.
And how can we do it differently?
Sure.
Like, yeah. We tend to think that this is the only way it can be done. And the truth is it's not. There are a lot of ways that people can be organized, not just hierarchies. There's a lot of innovation that has happened in the industry when it comes to technology and innovation that's happened when it comes to organizing people. Mm-hmm. And that has not been applied to production. It's pretty much been frozen in time for the past 100 years. So I think that when we can loosen our hold on that, really interesting things can start to come up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm sure Matt, you feel the same way, but I feel like there's been a cultural shift on set, at least from my experience, like over the past 15 years. Like when I first started PAing and doing, just working on small things, like people would yell at you all the time, and I've been fired from set. And,
sure.
But now I feel like, I kind of feel like part of what you're saying is like a version of something that we talk a lot about, which is like, just like be nice to people and also be open to ideas. Like, I think maybe the idea of a hierarchy is implying that like everything flows downhill, you know, but just being open to the idea that like this PA might have this great idea, you know, and not to be close to it, just to kind of establish a set where people are free to share their ideas, but also realize that there's a time limit and a budget limit and we need to like make decisions at some point. But yeah, I think kind of as a cultural shift, like at least what I've witnessed and what hopefully like on the sets I'm on happens is like people respect each other, you know, and listen to each other, even if you are three levels, you know, underneath mm-hmm. the person you're talking mm-hmm. to or whatever.
And I think that I'm not suggesting that then we will live in a utopian world where all the PA marches up to Video Village and suggests to the creative director what the shot should be or to the director. I think what I'm suggesting is that we look at that PA as a full and complete human being with facets to them other than just their title and what they're there to get coffee or empty the trash. And to answer your question, Matt, like one of the ways that we do that when we start to loosen our hold on tradition and free our minds up to innovate is that we completely redesigned the call sheet.
Oh, interesting. Ooh, tell us more about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. The call sheet started to think, look, this is completely a reinforcement of boxes and mm-hmm. hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what's on the call sheet is very old.
Sure.
You know, like if we have the weather on the call sheet often mm-hmm. and or the nearest hospital. And it's right. like, does the weather, that was back from the days like when before people had smartphones, they had to look at the call sheet for the weather.
Oh, sure. I do like having the weather on the call sheet, yeah. Not to be contrary.
When do you include the phone numbers on the call sheet and when don't you?
Well, we never include them now because we've redesigned the call sheet.
Yeah, so lay it on me. Because okay. I literally just read this movie and like call sheets were the bane of my existence. It was a really small team. And
did you have a second?
We didn't have a second and we'll get into it. Not having a second was probably the worst decision of the movie.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
the second AD is traditionally their job is to make the call.
Yeah. Yeah. So it ended up falling on me, but more the other producer ended up having to do a lot of that call sheet work and it was a bummer. So I'm ready to hear how
revolutionize.
Because it's a broken, the call sheet is like a broken system for sure. Like there's not great software for it. You know, it's a ton like of weird data entry.
Excel spreadsheet or something, right?
It's an Excel spreadsheet, but I was going to endorse actually. Are you familiar with Casper?
The mattress company?
No. The call sheet generating set of macros for Excel or for Google Sheets.
Oh. Yeah.
It's pretty nice. Wow. It's like super duper smart. Basically, once you do all the data entry, it like, you know, tallies how many, like what your page count is. It'll let you know if your call time, it'll like a cell will turn red if you set a call time before or after lunch or if you're going to hit meal penalties. It's like just like a set of macros that are super duper smart, but it's still, that's the best thing that I found, but it's still a slow, laborious process where you've probably already done all of that data entry. A couple other places.
Can you give it a script and it'll count the pages?
Yeah. All that's built in. It's really just a bunch of scripts in an Excel sheet. So it kind of shows you where you can, what you can touch and what you shouldn't touch. But like I said, tell me about this revolutionary call sheet plan.
Yeah. Now it's very lofty. It's a revolutionary sure. call sheet plan. All of a sudden. I said is that we've redesigned it. What we did is looked at, okay, if the call sheet doesn't have to be this way, how could it be? Mm-hmm. What's a different way? And so the way that our call sheets look is that we actually request photos of everybody on the crew. So we We have everybody's photo and it's organized by call time.
I physically just felt better from that.
Wait, how many, what is there a limit on crew size to do that? Like if you have a 100-person crew, you get all their photos?
Absolutely. And if somebody-
And how many, don't some people are like, I don't want my photo on the call sheet.
Well, actually, I was surprised because I thought that would happen a lot, but nobody has ever said, no, you can't have my photo for the call sheet, or what is this about? They actually, in the day, in the era that we're living in, people just send their photo. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get around to it because they're on set or maybe they're resisting silently, what we do is that we select a photo of a famous person who has the same first name.
That's fun.
For instance, that's if fun. Their name is Matt,
sure.
Then we would put in a photo of Matt Damon.
Oh, okay. I was going to go McConaughey, but sure.
Yeah, whatever. Exactly. Anyone. It can change.
All right.
So yeah, we have their photographs, and it's organized by call time. And then within that, it's alphabetical.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's alphabetical and organized by call time. And actually what that typically does is that it brings the people who are historically at the bottom of the call sheet to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And often those are the people that are the black and brown folks.
Wait, because it's PAs, alphabetical?
Because it's by call time.
Oh, it's by call time. Okay, yes.
Exactly. Yes. So a lot of times the PAs will be the first production, and PAs right. are the people at the top of the call sheet.
Right.
And so suddenly the people who are at the bottom are now at the top. Mm-hmm. And that means that the director or the client, because I work a lot in commercials and promos, like you said, they're all mixed in. So mm-hmm. they're going to be lower down on the call sheet mm-hmm. if you look at it in a vertical structure
yeah.
because of their call time.
And then I suppose their role is just kind of, the departments are typically kind of all called together, right? So it's not that big of an issue if you're like, ah, wait, who are the grips here or whatever? Like it's not.
Not
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
No, it's clear. And
it's
also
pretty quick. Yeah.
And it's easy to find yourself, one, because it's alphabetical, and two, because it's a photo that you have typically supplied. Mm-hmm. So if you just look at it, you can see your own photo very easily.
Wait, but it's alphabetical and by call time?
It's organized by call time first, and then within each category, because presumably people, more than one person would have an 8 a.m. call time. So then within that, instead of organizing it by position, it's mm-hmm. organized alphabetically. So if your call time is 8 a.m., all the people who have an 8 a.m. call time, their photos are there alphabetically.
Cool. And then do you use fancy names like production administrator?
That is not a fancy name.
Better than assistant, no?
It is. I mean, in a way, that whole like manager, coordinator, assistant is also an old language from...
Sure. And kind of a little confusing, frankly. You know, it would be better if it was... There's a way to clarify that, I'm sure, you know.
So what else do you do on this call sheet?
That's basically the call sheet. Yeah, and then...
And so there's their emails or any contact?
Emails. Account? Yeah, we don't put... Oh, this gets back to your question about phone numbers, and we don't put phone numbers because there's something that feels a little inappropriate to me about someone's photo and their phone number.
Right.
And actually, you don't need it.
So if you have a celebrity on set, do you... Also put a picture of a celebrity with the same name, same first name, but a different celebrity?
I just was on set with a celebrity on Tuesday, and we used a photo of that celebrity.
Yeah, yeah. I guess once they're famous enough that it's easy to just find a photo.
And is the publicist, you have to get the publicist to approve the call sheet?
We did not in this case, perhaps.
Can you tell us what celebrity?
It was Jamie Lee Curtis.
Oh, cool.
Phenomenal. She walked on set and shook everybody's hand, said, hi, I'm Jamie.
I love it when they do that.
Yeah. I knew it was going to be a good day.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good sign. The thing I love about going back to the call sheet for a second, most of the time what I need a call sheet for is to remind myself of someone's name. And having the photo, there you go. It's nice and easy. Do you print them out or is it just digitally transmitted?
We print one out and we post it on set.
Nice.
But it's mainly digital.
Yeah. Yeah,
and another thing that we do, and again, these aren't like things that maybe we might not even be doing these a year from now. But what we do now, we also have name tags on set.
Yeah. Yeah. I like name tags, but mine is always stuck to my boot. Like almost immediately. I'm like, oh, wait. Yeah.
Oh, we have nice name tags.
Stuck to your...
We don't have that kind of name tag. Yeah. We have legit.
Oh, you don't have the like, hello, my name is. You have like a lanyard.
We started with those, but we evolved. So now we have magnet name tags. So it has our logo.
We only hire
on it.
Cyborgs.
That's it. And then they're magnetized and it has your name
no
on
way.
It.
No way. Serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
That's pretty fancy.
And then we get them back at the end. We clean them off and use them for the next job.
Is that, did you get that idea from Greta Gerwig by any chance?
No, did she do that?
She like does name tags on set and then like every day she has a different prompt like, what's your favorite book? What did you eat for breakfast yesterday?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
We do something like that. I actually don't know anything about that, but we do something similar when we send out the call sheet.
Call sheet.
Ask a question.
Yeah, I do love the call sheet question.
So we send, say like, what series are you binge watching right now? And we get everybody's answers and we also post that on set. It becomes a good conversation piece for people.
Yeah. Now, do you find, because like I love all that stuff and it sounds so fun and cool and everyone gets to know each other better, but like sometimes like, I have a shoot tomorrow, and, you know, we're under-resourced as usual, and a lot of people are doing multiple jobs, and we're trying to figure out, and the script literally is, like, not locked yet, and our call time is 6 a.m. tomorrow. And so, like, you almost kind of need a person to manage the name tags and manage this stuff. Like, do you do it on every
set? You do have to have a team member who is happy to take it on, right? That's true. Yeah, like, someone has to be enthusiastic about it, right?
Yeah, we do have a person who's assigned to that. And I don't actually think that it takes more resources necessarily, but it does take a different kind of allocation of resources. And I think on some level, it's like a production polish, a production finesse. And I think when I started the company, one of the things I became very interested in is this idea of branding the production experience.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, I think the production, I think we overlook that production is an experience. We focus a lot on the customer experience or on the product. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at corporate culture right now, they focus a lot on the employee experience. Mm-hmm. But on set, we really ignore largely the production experience itself.
When you mean the production experience, you mean like the experience you are offering your clients or the experience you're offering the production people, the crew?
All of it. I think that we focus a lot on the experience that we offer the clients. Right? They'll be in Video Village. We get their coffee orders. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of focus on, like, maybe the talent's experience on set or the client. And then the crew is completely overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Disregarded. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, again, from a business perspective, I think if you walk on a typical set, it feels like any other set because we're all freelancers, right? So the same people, I love when companies are like, we have the best crew. I'm like, no, you don't. Yeah, we all have the same crew.
Same crew. And
your sound mixer.
Yeah.
Exactly. Was on our job yesterday. It's not like you have the best crew. And I think that this idea of when you walk on set with the light, you know you're on set with the light. Mm-hmm. From the second you walk on set, it's clear that you're inside of
and
a different kind of experience.
And to be clear, when you say that, you mean your production company.
I do. My production company.
Not when you're an electrician.
You're like, it's too
carrying
bright
a
here.
Light panel somewhere.
Yeah.
No, I asked for the pun.
No, that wasn't a pun. That was honestly for a second. I was like, when you walk on a set with the light, and then I realized the second later. So,
right.
Just making sure.
Not if you're a guest.
Listeners remember that the light is the name of your company. So going back to your website, which I love the domain, whatever you call the .com part of it, the subnet, whatever. It's the light.nyc, which is so cool.
Oh, that is cool.
But you have a tab called directors, and you have 8 directors listed on here. And under directors, it says top-notch free agents. And so does that mean that these directors are freelance directors, or they're not exclusive to your company?
Yes, that's what it means. Exactly. And actually, we have many more directors than that. That's who's listed on the website. We actually don't. I think that having a roster of signed directors, in my opinion, is part of like an old school paradigm, and it's not something that's a match for the way that we do business.
I think that's very interesting. I think that we're in a strange transitional period where I think there are a lot of people who are freelance and happy to be freelance and love that life, and then they're still kind of the biggest companies are all still roster oriented.
Yes.
And I think that the common argument is that, and it's something that we've experienced ourselves many, many times, if your company has sales reps and they're presuming that you're exclusive, then when they pitch you, if someone else pitches you as well, say the light pitches the director that some other company has pitched, then the sales reps feel they look invalid, or basically, or like they're not in the know, and all of a sudden there's a complication there. But that's the big thing that people are afraid of with, and the big advantage of exclusively being on a roster besides all of the marketing and support that you get.
Aww. I feel so bad for the sales reps who feel invalid.
Yeah, sure.
Well, invalid, but they're idea for you as a director. I've lost jobs because I've been pitched by multiple sales reps, and they're
it has legitimately been an actual problem. Like, mm-hmm. lost the job and like, accidentally burnt a bridge. Basically.
They're like, oh, we're not going to submit you anymore. You know, when you're a company that submits one director for a bid, which is, as directors, that's what we prefer, because we've worked with a lot of companies that submit like 5 directors, and they want us to like do this work and save the state and do all this time and rearrange our life for this job. that they don't even have. But then we find out it's not just that they pitched us. They pitched like four other directors.
But the point is like, you know, like.
Yeah. It's not about the poor sales reps. It is about the, as a director, being pitched by multiple people is tends to not be a good thing.
I mean, like if you're a client.
To the same client.
And like one person is pitching you a person and then a different person is pitching you that person, then all of a sudden it's just like, that's complicated enough. They're just like, well, no, we'll just go with someone else. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I get it. I think that's like, that may happen sometimes.
I'm curious about how you deal with that and what your perspective is on it.
Yeah, I think that's, like you said, that could happen and that's unfortunate when it does happen. Or I've had people contact me and be like, wait, I think I'm already being submitted for this same job.
Right.
Be like, okay, well then I won't submit you. But I also think that there's different kinds of work that exist out there. So I've been working in this business for 15 years. And when I started, we were shooting on film. We would get bags, cans, cores, and camera reports. You know, I worked on $2 million commercials mm-hmm. where I was chartering private planes to go on a tech scout.
Right.
Okay.
Do you think of those as the good old days?
Or no?
Yeah.
It was a private plane from LAX to Burbank.
To actually, what's that place that's near Barstow?
Oh,
yeah.
LAX, it was Santa Monica Airport to Barstow.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Wow.
The key grip was like, this is the best day of my life. Yeah. Best tech scout ever.
I mean, Barstow. It is a drive.
Yeah.
See, there's still a place for those kinds of, big budget jobs with the high-end commercial directors. And there's a place for that. But there's also the industry's blown open. And there's so many other kinds of jobs out there. And I think what we're really focused on is this idea of elevating production. So a lot of the clients that come to us because one, they trust us to work with directors who are competent and qualified and mm-hmm. talented. And they also come to us for the production experience. Mm-hmm. So often they'll come to the light and they'll ask, who's a director that you want to put on this job? As opposed to them coming for the directors, which is a shift I'm talking about when it comes to production. Because often what in the traditional model, it's all about, it's director driven. Mm-hmm. And the production company is there to be a vehicle for this talent, which is the visionary director. Mm-hmm. And I think that as jobs get different and smaller, or they're for social or they're lower budget, that idea of this iconic visionary auteur.
Sure. Ridley Scott isn't going to do every single
director. Exactly.
RSN. Instagram spot for. Yeah,
exactly. Gotcha. The director then becomes a member of the team in a different way, the same way that we have an art director, the same mm-hmm. way we have a cinematographer, a DP, or a producer, that the director's status doesn't become this elevated, mm-hmm. extolled thing that we all worship and serve. It becomes somebody who has a very specific function on the set. Mm-hmm. And I think that's often what people don't understand about directors, or at least that's not what I understood when I was in film school.
Sure.
You know, I thought.
Yeah, right. Auteur
well,
theory.
I mean, I guess just to offer a counter point, it's the directors are like a DP is not writing a treatment and spending 3 weeks bidding for a job and then the schedule pushes and then they're like, you know, they're not watching a project through post. The production designer, the art director, the editor, none of those people aside from the producer is really on the job that entire time that the director is on that job. So if a director, you know, gets $3,000 for this 1 day shoot, they've really spent like a month and a half on it, you know, and obviously they're doing other things too, but it's not about them being an elevated auteur sometimes, but there is like a shepherding that they're going to do of the project that like probably no other person
right.
from a creative standpoint is going to do except for maybe someone at an ad agency.
Yeah,
not necessarily. Yeah. Again, I think there's different types of jobs and maybe that's for sure one type of job, but a lot of jobs that I'm on, we don't triple bid them. A director doesn't spend 3 weeks doing a treatment. They come to us and they say, who do you want to put on this job? And we hire a director and show them they're real. They're not doing, maybe once they're on the job, they'll put together a treatment, but they're not being awarded the job based on the director's treatment.
Right.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe the other part of what Oren's point was, because I think that's wonderful and also frankly, like a relief, right? Because sometimes the pressure of like, oh, if my ideas aren't good, then this whole company doesn't get the job. And like, they're all our friends, you know, like I want to keep the lights on. You know what I mean? That's a lot of pressure.
And as directors, we would prefer for someone to sit call and say, hey, can you direct this thing?
Yeah.
You know, in 2 weeks.
Yeah, sign me up. But the thing is that even if you're not maybe doing all of that prep work of the work for free of getting the job, the director is still the likely the only person who's had all of the conversations that it takes to make an informed decision about art direction or the cinematography or something. Like, I often say that it's like, so much of the time you're just course correcting. If you hire a great crew, then everyone's coming up with awesome ideas, but it's not, is this idea good or bad? Is, does it serve the overall creative, right? And so oftentimes people haven't had all of the conversations. They haven't been in the PPM. They haven't talked to the client. You know, all of those, all that prep work is so that you get in tune with what the client really needs and how to kind of like sculpt and shift for them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I
do. So it's not like my vision. It's just like, you know, like, well, look, I've just spent a couple weeks talking about
directors.
This.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, I'm in a conversation with directors.
Right,
so
right.
It is a little,
no, for sure. That, and that's the point of view of the podcast. You know, it is from a director's point of view. And I do, like, for sure, there's like, there could be a big job where they're like, hey, Regina King is going to be available on Thursday. We need to film her in this Cadillac and we're going to do this. And it's like kind of all coming together. And the director literally is just like, hey, can you just like make a shot list and show up on set and make sure that everything goes the way it needs to go and not figure this out, you know?
Right.
For us. And in that regards, for sure, there are just like kind of they more like a DP, more like a production designer, more like, here's the job. Here's how to do it. Go do it.
Would you say, Becky, that maybe some of what used to be a director's job has shifted to the production company?
I mean, I can't speak for the industry as a whole. And like I'm saying, there's definitely different facets of the industry. And I think that in my experience, often people will, a client will come and they will know from the beginning they want to work with our production company.
Right.
So that's locked in. There's no triple bid, anything like that. What then happens is we may cycle through directors who we're going to, you know, assign to that job and that the client agrees on, but they already know they're going to work with a light. So I'd say that that's maybe different than a traditional model. And I think what I'm talking about the director is, you know, the director has a specific function on the set in the same way that other people do. And I do think that there is a historical idea of what a director is, which is more than just their role.
Yeah,
a director visualizes the script, right? They'll do the storyboards. They'll come up with the shot list. They'll direct the actors. They'll make decisions. But they're definitely, it's undeniable that there is a idea of the director as a force that is the one that we are there to serve. I mean, that is, I mean, again, I've worked with hundreds of directors in my career, and that's typically the idea of the director. That there's either,
I guess that feels icky, right?
I feel like to me,
that's,
but to me, like a, for me, if I've done like an excellent job directing, then it means I probably don't even need to be on set. Because I've communicated so well with the actors, with the producers, the agency, like the DP. And like if I show up and I'm like deathly ill and I have to go, you know, to the bathroom for 2 hours, that the shoot can go on without me because
but
it's not really to me about the on-set time as much as the either side of on-set time.
Right, but I think we're talking about maybe two different things here, right? Like you're talking about the job of directing and you're talking, Becky, you're talking about
the attitude.
The attitude that we...
Towards directors.
Yeah. And that is what I'm talking about. Because being on the flip side of, I think that being a producer for many years, it is. I'm there to serve the director and to serve the client and to be an intermediary between the two. And I think that really, in a way, everyone on set is there to serve the director's vision, whether or not it's a lofty vision is, you know, up for interpretation. But that's why, that's the way that it's modeled. That
but what's funny
is
I think of like my job, like tomorrow there's going to be an agency and a client there and a producer. And I think, yes, the producer's job is to make me happy at the same time she's making the agency happy. And the agency's job is to make the producer happy at the same time they're making the client happy. And my job is to make the producer happy at the same time I'm making the DP and the production designer and wardrobe and makeup and all those people happy. Mm-hmm. So I think we're all doing the same job. It's just at a different... So because you as the producer happen to be like right between the director and the client, you feel like part of your job is to support the director as a producer. But as a director, I feel like part of my job is to support the DP when the DP says like, there's no way we can do this many shots. And I would say, let's get another camera. And the producer's like, we don't have the budget for another camera. Like I'm trying to serve the DP who, and ultimately, in my opinion, like serve the client and the agency and make the producer look good.
And the creative.
Yeah. So everyone, I think, feels like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to please this person above me and make the person that I hired happy, you know?
When you say like serve the director, it puts a pit in my stomach, right? And so I think that part of the show is about figuring out like, oh, everyone does something different, right? And so, or every director does it differently. So what I'm getting at is that separate from the way that Oren and I see ourselves and the way that we like to do the work, have you seen a shift in the attitude of directors that you work with and the way in which they approach the work and the way in which they are expected to be treated? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think like a lot of what you're talking about, I genuinely hope I don't ever convey that to people or expect that of people or you know, I'm hoping that I do it differently than what maybe historically people have expected, right?
Right. I'm sure, but even like if a gaffer calls you boss, you're like,
yeah, I don't
please
like
don't
it.
Call me that.
Yeah, for sure. And would ask them not to. But so taking us out of the equation, I guess, is what I'm saying. Like because it's such a personal thing, you know? Have you seen differences over the years? Do you know what I mean? Or is it just the...
Like on that $2 million commercial versus like a sure. $20,000 right. promo you're shooting. Like, have you seen the attitudes of the director be different on... across that span? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, or even just more modern, like in the last 5 years since you started The Light, are you attracting people who don't expect that sort of mentality?
I'd say it's a mix. And I think what I'm talking about is I'm very interested in a systems perspective, mm-hmm. right? And so while you're right, like that may be something that makes that you on set, you're a benevolent, kind, generous, collaborative
sure.
human
a benevolent
being.
King.
You're a benevolent director king. You're not a director dictator, right?
Right
there
right.
may be someone who is on set has a different
correct.
Attitude, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you were to take out your individual personalities from the equation, from a system standpoint, that is the role of the director. Like mm-hmm. there is, if you go to the history, the director was initially called the director general. And then they drop general from the title.
Right.
So the idea is that in this militaristic factory-based paradigm, the director does have that role where mm-hmm. everyone is there to serve the director. I mean, whether that's your personal preference or not, that's the role. And I what I'm talking about is that as we march towards equity and inclusion and sustainability and a different kind of future, that we cannot do that without actually examining and dismantling parts of the system that are in their very nature obsolete.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm talking about with yeah. the director. No matter if you have the most like incredible
sure.
kind
yeah.
director on set,
the system is still broken. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I guess I just feel like you get different types of things in The Light, you know, so we have friends that have a company called Sawhorse, and I think they work very similar to The Light. They a lot of their jobs, probably more than 50% of their jobs, they are approached by the client or by an agency, and they're really, really, really amazing at post-production. And their clients know, like, no matter what we give you and how crazy this job is, you're going to find someone to do it. That all the people that own the company have like really good taste, and they make sure everything they put out is great, and they make sure the post is going to be top notch. And so the director isn't really like that, like the question mark of who's going to direct this isn't going to make this either like the worst thing ever or the best thing ever.
It's already their job. Yeah.
There's already yeah. a minimum quality that you're going to expect from going to Sawhorse, which I feel like is probably a similar thing to The Light. And correct me if I'm wrong, but what I hear you saying is like you've built this company in a way that it's a little, it can withstand like any crew member changing is not going to destroy this project because you've built the system where no one person has like the power to make or break this unless their name is Becky Morrison.
No, God, no, not at all. Yes, you were so close, Oren. You were 99% of the way there until that last part. But yeah, that's exactly it. And I would say the one thing I would say is that it's not that we have created that, but what you're describing is what we're working towards, where from a systems perspective that when you walk onto set, that we are putting people through a process wherein they naturally, at the end of that, feel better when they leave set than when they arrived. Because the fact is that's not the process they are often put through now. Sometimes they do, but sometimes people do not feel better mm-hmm. when they leave set than when they arrived. Often during the safety meeting in the morning, I speak a little bit about this and I'll say, raise your hand if you've ever been yelled at on set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, many people raise their hand. And then I say, raise your hand if you've ever left set feeling worse than when you arrived. And 100% of the people raise their hand. So what I'm talking about is creating a process and a system and an experience wherein that does not happen anymore. Because the fact is that we're operating inside of an invisible system, which produces those results. And that by becoming conscious of the system and actually consciously creating the system, we can produce different results. That's what I'm talking about. And that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah. So I'm curious then. So it sort of almost feels like you're saying you're systematizing being nice, right? Which is wonderful. Can you give me a few other examples of the ways in which you've implemented, like, kind of the specifics of it, you know? Like, totally. So we've got name tags, we've got the improved safety meeting, we've got a better call sheet.
Exactly. We pay people within 72 hours of wrap.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, there you go.
That's nice.
Yeah.
We reach out to everybody in advance and we ask what their dietary restrictions are and what their snack requests are. And part of this, it's...
I like that one. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's like you want to make set fun or you do these games. And they always know not to say that word in front of me because I get up. I'm like, it's not a game. It's actually... Yeah.
It's real life.
This is serious, everyone. Because it is. It's part of people being acknowledged for who they are. Maybe you are allergic to cashews.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's important for us to know. Sure. I don't know. We don't put cashews in lunch and then nobody asks you and then you don't eat lunch. And another thing we do is we listen to the crew. We have a way where we receive feedback from them on every job. We say, what did we do well? What could we do better? What are other ideas you have?
Okay, now Becky, you have 6 jobs in the span of 4 weeks. You have to do pre-production, post-production, fly around the country, calls, all that stuff. And you're still, when that is happening, you're still getting feedback from your last shoot on like who liked the cashews?
Yes, that's exactly right. Right before I came here. I mean, that's exactly describing my life. I mean, we had a shoot yesterday in New York. I didn't produce. We had a shoot on Tuesday here in LA, one this weekend, one the weekend before. It's exactly what's happening right now. We have feedback forms. And we pass out feedback forms and we have them fill them out. And then someone scans them and we read them.
There isn't enough paperwork already.
No, it's right. All of our time cards are digital. So it's the only piece. Yes.
That's very cool.
Yes. Yeah. And it's the only piece of paper they fill out. And the thing is that, you know, a big part of what we do is listening to the crew, because for me, that's an untapped gold mine of ideas.
Yeah.
Because for a while, we've been doing like longer types of crew interviews too,
mm-hmm.
and asking people, how do you think things could be done differently? And the truth is that all of them have ideas, that most of their ideas are good and nobody is listening to them. They always say, wow, no one has ever asked me this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have ideas and some of them are very easily implementable. And when we do, it makes a difference for them and it elevates the whole brand. And it seems to me like, well, why aren't we listening to people more?
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. I feel like there is kind of like the journey person director who is freelance, who's going from gig to gig, who's bidding with this company and now this company and now this company, and they're making this. And it's like, they are not, it's not really about their vision. It's about being part of a team. And then there are like the Brian Buckleys of Hungry Man, you know, there's like the Lance Accords of, you know, Park Pictures. There's, you know, a mm-hmm. billion great, like John and Val, the directors that did like Little Miss Sunshine, that also do commercials that are repped at one company, Anonymous or wherever they are. And you know that that company is pushing them and giving them money to do a short film so that they can prove that they can do sports stuff or whatever, you know. And it's like a different type of relationship. It's less about the family of the crew and the director, and it's more about the production company and the director and like working towards like a specific like artistic vision. And that's kind of like right now in my life, that is like a little bit of like my dream, you know, is to like be in a place where people are like, oh yes, we are hiring you, Oren, because you're Oren, not because you are a director that is a cog that fits into this production company. And obviously it's like coming from this like orthogonal point of view to you, because you're building a company that's big, that's with, should be able to withstand anything and scale and handle throughput, and also make stuff that you're proud of because you have good people working with you. But as a director, I think we're always working to try to break that, you know, like I don't want to make like 7 good promos. I want to make 1 amazing Geico commercial, you know?
Yeah. But I'd like to say something about that, because I think that that's totally fair and there's a place for that. But the fact is that that is also a very masculine paradigm. And there really has not been a lot of room for women or people of color inside of that paradigm. And I think that what I'm talking about is creating an inclusive vision for production. And what I have seen is that, for instance, we work with a lot of female directors. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting as I've started to work with female directors, because I've worked with male directors for my entire career. I did not work with a single female director until last year. Okay.
Oh.
So I've worked with many male directors, and what you're describing in the you know, typical model, traditional model, is this idea of like also competition and winning, mm-hmm. bidding, competition and winning, right? And conquering, which is, and that I think in myself, that is a lot of what I took on mm-hmm. in order to succeed in this business, like a very masculine operating system
sure,
my own personality.
Yeah.
And what I'm seeing as I work with more women, that's not the way that a lot of women work. And that what I'm seeing is many women directors that we work with actually have clients in their network, but they didn't have a production company who was repping them. Mm-hmm. So now they're bringing their clients to the light so that they can direct things. And the whole way that they're working is very different. It's a lot more open, and there's more like, how can we help each other? How can we help each other? Like female directors, one thing that we recently did is that there was a job that wanted to have a female director. And I brought female directors together, three female directors, and said, who wants to do this job? Let's talk about it together. As opposed to the typical way, which would be that I would choose one, I would share them with a mm-hmm. client. We'd get that approved. And then I go back to them. I said, let's talk this out. Who feels like they're the best suited for this job?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and knowing that they're not, the same person's not going to get the job over and over again. But maybe you love fashion and you don't love fashion. So let's talk it out together. And there's less of that sense of competition. And so I think that while you're describing absolutely has a place and still is 90% of the industry, I'm describing an alternative world mm-hmm. that we are building, because there's not a lot of room for us in that other world.
My experience is not like that. Like,
of course not.
There are, I know it seems, and I'm very happy to be like taught that I'm wrong, you know, but like the competition of it all is not something that I enjoy in any way. Like I think Matt and I would both rather be called, like, my job tomorrow I got because I did a similar campaign for the same company last year, and they just were like, we need to shoot this thing in a week. Oren, can you do it? And that is by far my preferred method of getting work, of spending all my time collaborating and none of my time competing. But there, yes, I'm obviously traditionally like these like big powerhouse commercial directors have been male, but there's a lot of really great female commercial directors. You know, Matt and I have had a lot on the podcast. We've competed against a lot. We've like won against them. We've lost to them. I don't think we ever enjoy like beating someone else, but as directors, we want to work. And, you know, for us, like, shooting 10 things a year is like a pretty good year, you know? So it's less about beating other people or the competition or anything. I don't think we like that we're up against other people. I think it's wanting the job and having like a voice that is like nurtured, whether regardless of who you are. I mean, I understand what you're saying, that that's maybe like a masculine attitude.
I think it comes back to what we were just talking about before, which is this idea of like dissociating the people who are sitting in this room or who are listening from the system.
Mm-hmm.
And while that may not be something all that you enjoy, and that's amazing, and that may not be, it may put a pit in your stomach when people look at you that way. What I'm talking about is a system that has existed over 100 years. I mean, commercials have been around maybe less than that, right? 1941 was the first commercial, and film was invented in 1890. But historically, that system has not had room for different types of people, and that the system itself was created 100% by white men. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe not 100, but like 90%.
Sure, sure.
And that we're living now in the legacy of that system. And while we may not, individually adhere to all the values of it, mm-hmm. that we're living with the legacy of a 100-year-old system, which is that. Like, the fact is that production, you know, when the first organizational systems were created for the studios, this was at a time before women had the right to vote. This was a time, right. You know, when there was segregation. This was a time, like, that was the time when, if you think about it, if you go back to 1914 or even 1920, people were riding around in horse-drawn carriages. People did not have refrigerators in their home. In 1914, World War I was going on. And, you know, this was a totally different era when these systems were created. So cut to 2020, the fact is that while we may not like those in our individual expression or agree with them, we are still using the same system. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's fair to call that system masculine, whether or not.
Whether you want it to be or not.
Right. But look at the example you brought up of the three female directors. Like, I'm assuming one of them ended up getting the job.
Yes.
And two didn't.
Yeah.
So if you were one of those three directors and you were like, oh, I need to pay my rent this month. And now Becky just called me and she said, oh, there's a job that that we're considering you for, but we're also considering two other directors for. Do you think you should get it? Like, what makes you not want to fight to get the job?
I think that, well, what I'll say about that is that that is typically what would happen is that that would happen in a non-transparent way. That what would happen was that that conversation wouldn't happen with the directors. Mm-hmm. The conversation would have, I mean, I would make the decision.
Right. Mm-hmm. You'd be talking to the client. Here's three
exactly.
reels.
And what I'm saying now is that we're going to make that decision together as mm-hmm. a group. So you're right. If you have bills to pay and you want to really get that job, then let's talk about it together. And if that's, you know, I guess it's
a little bit of like, well, when don't you have bills to pay?
Right. And also, you know, like, and nobody wants to get a job like as a producer. You're probably not like going to say, well, we'll give Matt the job because he's in debt right now. You know, right. That's not a good reason. You want the best person for the project.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm all for transparency. When I'm like this company Sawhorse, sometimes they're like, hey, you should look at Oren to direct this thing and like five other directors. And I always ask them, like, who are the other five directors? And sometimes I see like, oh, you know, Carlin or Matt or this other person, this is like right in their wheelhouse.
Sure.
You should probably go with them.
It's nice. It's
exactly.
That's a wonderful feeling. I guess it's like there's the dichotomy of like, if there were three jobs and it was like, oh, well, who gets each one? Then it's easy. Right. But when I think your point of like the competition, it's like when you may not work that month, right? Realistically, you know, how many jobs are you up for in a month? It's a lot harder to be like, oh, well, this one, I think this is better for that person. You know?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
It's nice for it to be it's nice for you to be like, oh, well, Matt doesn't have anything on his reel that would work. So like, we'll just go to this person, to someone else. You know what I mean?
I do. And I don't think I certainly don't want to imply that we do that on every job. It was more of an experiment and it worked. And I think that it's having a conversation. And I think that if the understanding, if it's coming from a place that's not of scarcity and lack, and it's the idea that there's going to be another job next month where that's possible. And that then if I'm not going to take this one, I'll take the next one. Mm-hmm. You know, I've done that. The first job I ever produced was an accident, actually. And I got a call and they said, okay, there's two projects that I want to talk to you about. One is a motion capture car commercial, mm-hmm. and one is like a concert green screen job. Mm-hmm. Now, my uncle was in the rock and roll business. I danced on stage with Michael Jackson when I was eight, which is no longer as cool as it was a few years ago. He toured with the Grateful Dead. I grew up backstage at rock concerts, and I'd done a lot of green screen. I'd never done a car commercial. I'd never done mocap, and I had never produced a job before. So what happened, and this was an executive producer calling. I was actually a production manager at the time. And I ran into this executive producer at a party who I had worked with years ago. And he told me, I want to talk to you about these jobs. And I thought, does he know I'm just a production manager? Because mm-hmm. why would an EP want to talk to me? But I thought, okay, let me just talk to him anyway.
Sure.
Told me about both of those jobs. I thought about it and I thought, you know what? Like, I don't want to do that motion capture car commercial. I don't. I don't feel comfortable doing that.
Right.
And yeah, you're right. Maybe I wasn't going to work that month, but for me, it didn't matter. I didn't feel comfortable and I didn't want to put him in a bad position.
Right. You had danced with Michael Jackson.
I had danced with Michael Jackson.
You didn't need anything
Damn
else.
It. I didn't have to do a motion capture car commercial. And I turned it down. And actually what ended up happening is that job didn't come through. And I texted him that I wasn't comfortable doing the job. I got on the subway. And I went to meet a friend for coffee. I had a coffee. I got out of the coffee and I had voicemails from this executive producer and texts. And I was like, what? And I listened to my voicemail and he said, hey, Becky, so it turns out that the green screen concert shop, came through, it awarded. I just put you on a chain with the agency producer and let's start talking about a DP. And I said, what? I turned that job down. And I looked and I saw the budget in my email. And I saw that it was 20 days of a producer for $1,000 a day. Mind you, I was a production manager at this time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I looked and I saw that the text I had sent him turning the job down had a red exclamation point next to it because I had gone into the subway. So it never went through.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And I thought,
so New York.
I thought, well, you got to start sometime. Rock and roll, yeah. Let's rock and roll, baby. So I did that job. I did that job. And that was my first job I ever produced. But anyway, yeah. I didn't do the motion capture card commercial. So that was the point.
So your example of turning down jobs is the job you had 20 grand on.
Exactly. Exactly. Self-awareness paid off.
I love it.
Well, that's cool. Well, anything...
I do actually have... Because I think that there are going to be plenty of people who will be like, oh, man, this sounds incredible. Sign me up. I want to learn what it's like to be a part of this new system in the light. What are you looking for in a collaborator? How do you find these new directors and voices that you want to work with?
Do they have to live in New York?
No, not at all. We have directors all over the place. I think that, well, there's a few questions inside of that, right? Mm-hmm. The questions, is it about like how we find new talent, new directors?
Yeah, let's start with that. That's
okay.
Great. Yeah.
So that's a good question because I do think that if people cold email us, mm-hmm. we don't typically, someone does read those emails, but typically
yeah.
it's not me. And we don't go with people that way because.
Have you ever signed anyone or even like worked with someone, I mean, from a cold email?
No. Okay. No.
But there is, I feel like there is this thing, it's like actors, right? If someone sent you a cold email with like an incredible reel of stop motion stuff and you got boards for a stop motion job and you don't have a director, you might be like, oh, well, I got this director, I got this project, maybe.
Probably right. not. No, we wouldn't do that. Even I don't know, because there's, I think that trust is such a big part of this business and that like someone just emailing, you can't feel or see what they're like as a human being. And that's a huge part of what we're talking about is like really how someone, I'd much rather work with the director.
That's why you
got
a video message, people.
There, that could work. Knock on the door of the office.
Yeah.
No, I'd much rather work with a director who I know who they are, their character and their personality and who they are as a person who has less experience than I would with a director who has a lot of experience who I don't know mm-hmm. at all. Although I would say that, you know, this everything runs off recommends. So if somebody recommended a director to me who I didn't know and I saw their reel and they had a great stop motion reel, then I would reach out and talk to them and ideally like meet with them before we were to do a job together because it's such a liability to have like.
Sure.
And just to play devil's advocate for the first time ever, do you think like your whole like ethos of inclusion, but you will only kind of take people that are recommended from within your circle and your network, does that works against that kind of philosophy in some way?
It's a good point. I think it's a balance, you know, of like liability and inclusion. I think we have had an innovation lab at the Light recently, and we did talk a lot about that, about what does inclusion really mean? And if inclusion is only that my cousin is going to get a job or somebody's that
right.
you people
or you
know.
Probably hang out with you live in Brooklyn, you know, you have like a specific type of person and, you know, group of people.
And work in advertising, right? Like that's a pretty narrow circle, right?
Well, and we've talked about that a lot. We talked about how can we bring people who may not be inside of this mm-hmm. network at all into the industry. And we're developing a mentorship program and we're offering workshops, free and low cost workshops at the office that industry professionals are teaching so that people can be educated and like, what does a grip actually do? Mm-hmm. How does this work? But we're looking at it more that those people would be in from you know, a lower level position, mm-hmm. not that they would come in as a director. I think that there is something, it's a big responsibility. The same way hiring producers for me, because as I'm passing the torch and not producing all the jobs, if someone just emailed me and said, I'm a producer, it's very unlikely that I would mm-hmm. hire that person for a job. Just, I'm being honest.
Sure.
You know?
No, and that's so helpful. So then are you, when you're getting those recommendations, are you soliciting them? Are you like asking a peer group of like, hey, I'm looking for this type of person, like looking for this on their reel or something? Or is it more that like they're coming to you with like, oh, I think you guys would really click?
Mm-hmm. It's both.
Both. Yeah.
It's both. Yeah, it depends on the situation. Sometimes we ask for recommends and sometimes people say, oh, they know how we are and they say, you got to meet this person. They're totally.
Yeah.
I find the best way to find new directors is to go on their podcast.
Wait a minute. I see what's going on here.
Go. Yeah. It's weird. We've only had producers. And hire directors on the podcast.
Is this thing even on?
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Well, Becky, this is awesome. Thank you for showing us the light. Insert your light pun here. Are you cool with endorsing something with us?
Yes.
Unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements.
Okay, so I'm shooting this thing tomorrow, and it takes place in a kitchen. And it's I was just trying to come up with like funny bits to do in the kitchen, and I realized like if you are ever trying to find like a funny, like physical gag to do in any location, just like type into YouTube, Mr. Bean and the name of the location and you will just find like,
wait, are you endorsing cribbing Mr. Bean bits?
Life hack.
Yeah. Well, so do you want me to tell you the bits that we came up with?
Yeah, there's
tomorrow?
A turkey on his head.
So
and
it's
like
he
makes
inspired
funny
by
faces. He smells something strange.
I honestly, the turkey on my
no.
head. No, we're not doing that. But I was like, how can I do our version of the turkey on the head?
It is an incredible bit.
But so I got a food processor, a Cuisinart food processor, and we rigged it with so that you can turn it on without closing the lid. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have him put like some bell peppers in the food presser. Right. Yeah. And then just fly all over the place. And then we have, this is like kind of from a Johnny English thing, which is Mr. Bean also. And so he makes this giant mess on the counter and he like basically just takes all the mess. He wipes it off the counter into like a drawer, that there was no drawer there, that we added the drawer so he can open it. And then I actually pitched this, but the actor we're working with vetoed it. But he's making this bowl of chili, and I thought it would be fun if he like puts his finger in there, like in the suave, charming fashion to like taste the chili, and it's like insanely hot, but he's like pretending that it's not that hot. And we also have sour cream. This whole thing we're doing is for Bush's baked beans and chili. That his finger is so hot that he like sticks it in the bowl of sour cream, like cold sour cream, and you just hear the tss.
That's funny.
And then later on, when he's trying to put the shredded cheese on the chili, it's like all sticking to his hand because he's got sour cream all over his hand. So. Yeah, so it's less about like stealing exactly something they did, but more about like getting inspired by like his physicality. Because, you know, it's like international. There's no language. There's no nothing. Everything he does is like, it's not relatable because it's so over the top, but it's kind of like he's the Jackie Chan of comedy, right? Like Jackie Chan can turn a shower curtain into like a tightrope or whatever. And Mr. Bean can turn a turkey into a hat. Yeah, so... Yeah.
It's an homage. Yeah. I can't wait to see the spot.
So Mr. Bean space location, you are setting something funny in and you will get many ideas.
That's great, man. I love that. So I've got a couple endorsements. One is Casper Call Sheets. It's Casper. It's for Excel or for Google Sheets. And it's basically just a smart way of building out the call sheet. A lot of it is automated, which is really nice. And there's also a kind of complicated, but not too gnarly way of exporting stuff from Movie Magic and then into Casper. So you don't have to do as much data entry as you could. So that's super handy. I've got an LA specific one. The Alamo Draft House season pass is now available to everyone. So for the low price, $29.99.
A month?
A month. You can go see a movie a day. I'm so excited about it.
Are you going to do that?
Yeah.
It's like, what was that one called that was around? Movie Pass?
Movie Pass.
Netflix. That was awesome.
It was like Movie Pass, but for Alamo Draft House. I go to the Draft House enough that it'll all net out, no problem.
Wow.
We have one in Brooklyn as well, right by my house.
They may have their season pass available there. They're rolling it out.
I mean, that is you have to go to the movies a lot to make that worth it.
You have to go to the movies twice.
Yeah, $29.99. That's how much it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
awesome. You have to go
twice a month.
Twice a month, yeah. Yeah. Well, and that includes like all of their like the repertory stuff that they're doing. Like, I would definitely go twice a month. Okay. Yeah. I'm also fortunate that like the metro is like a walkable distance for me and then it lets out right there. So I'm very excited.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
So glad I came here to learn that.
Yeah.
Draft House. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. So, Becky.
Okay. Let's see. Well, I have two. I have now that I know that I can have two. So mm-hmm. I have an industry one and a non-industry one.
Love it.
Cool.
Love it.
So, what industry?
Well, our industry.
Oh.
So
the
I was,
podcasting industry.
The podcasting industry. Yeah. The non-industry one is I'd like to endorse West African dance classes.
Oh.
Yes. In pretty much every major city around the globe, there are West African dance classes happening.
Yeah. I think I'm aware of one here in Los Angeles, actually, that I have friends who've done. Yeah. And have had a great time. Yeah.
Yes. There's several here in Los Angeles. Yeah, yeah. I've been studying.
One at Paper or Plastic?
Oh, I don't know that.
Yeah. Yes.
There's a great West African dance here, a class here taught by Dante that is amazing at the Mid-City Arts Center.
Cool.
Oh, nice.
But I think in general, I've been studying West African dance for 18 years.
Whoa.
Okay.
And it's a great way.
So it is not a trend for you.
No, it is not a trend. And then the industry thing I would like to shout out is room tone. I love room tone. I think that, you know, as somebody who practices awareness and meditation and consciousness, the opportunity on set for there to be everybody to be silent together every time it happens, I'm like, yes.
Oh, so it's not even about the room tone. It's about the moment.
It's about the moment where everybody is, you know, bustling, working, distracted. And then there's a moment where, for those of you who don't know what room tone is, it's when everybody stops what they're doing on set, stands still, sits there, and is completely silent so that the sound person can capture the ambience of the room.
Yeah. I think Jeff Goldblum has a bit about room tone. I think like a late night story, or he's on something talking about room tone. It's quite charming. Yeah.
I'm going to Google that.
Well, cool. Well, thanks, Becky. If people want to find out more about you, obviously there's the light.nyc. There's also, if they have a laptop that works, but they're not using, should they check out Globetops?
That would be great. Yes.
.com? Or how
yes, Globetops.com.
Cool.
Exactly.
Do you tweet or anything?
We do. We're at the light is lit.
Ooh, nice.
On Instagram and Twitter.
Cool. And are you, is there an at Becky Morrison or anything?
There's an at that Bex.
Ooh, that's not bad. With an X or
with
a CKS? That Bex.
Yep. And there's an at Globetops.
There you go. Well, anyway, if you want to learn more about the things that we talked about on this show, you can go to justshootapod.com to see all of the stuff that we talked about and our endorsements and everything. We're across all social media at justshootapod. And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow.
I'm at O'Kaplan on Instagram. And you can find me in other places if you want. This episode was edited by Jonathan Luna. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And you're listening to music from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.